Hello and welcome to another of my comedy interviews for my blog, A Rich Comic Life. My name is Richard Gill and I've seen to date over 750 and counting comedians over the last 45 years, and my blog documents every experience that I've had with them. I'm delighted today to have as my very special guest one of my favourite comedians. It's only Mr. Hal Cruttendon. Yes!
Thank you.
Hello! How are you?
I'm very well.
Thank you so much for being my guest. I'm absolutely delighted.
No problem. I didn't know I was going to be being videoed. So this is my non-work clothes, the Saracens rugby shirt, and I'm in my wife's office. So I'm not this, it looks artistic, doesn't it? She's an artist. But not. So I'm feeling a little bit self-conscious, but also, yeah, I think this is actually a better, this looks good. But yes, I'm fine. Yes.
Great.
Well, it does feel weird because no day seems normal anymore, does it?
No, it's weird times.
Yeah.
But I am genuinely delighted that you're here. And today, we're going to talk about your comedy career. So it's all about you. And we're going to go right back to the start. And please, can you tell me what inspired you to be a comedian in the first place?
Do you know, it's always a weird story because it didn't even cross my mind till I was 26. I'd been an actor for, well, basically a couple of years. I did some child acting. I went to drama school after university. I was a student for years. I was messing about. I was struggling as an actor. Right. And I had been to the Comedy Store and I'd always looked at comedy and gone, could never do that. That's horrendous. And a friend of mine who I wasn't doing that much acting work. So a friend of mine who I was working with at doing BBC Traffic and Travel was doing a stand-up comedy workshop. And he said to me, you could do stand-up, you know, and I'm going, oh no, I couldn't. And he said, I'm doing this course and you should think about doing it.
Wow.
And so I joined that course. But I still remember when he said it, I went, there was a moment where I went, yes, actually, I was sort of thinking I'll do this course because I want to write one-man shows that are all very theatrical. Like, do you remember John Sessions used to do these things?
Yeah,
it was actually
a big
influence on me. Yeah, Travelling Tales or something, Life of Napoleon. And I'd seen these and thought, that's exactly what I want to do. And then I thought, oh, I'll do this stand-up course because that'd be, you know, I was at that time, I was not getting much acting work. I was doing bits and bobs. But as soon as I started doing this stand-up comedy course, which the woman who runs it, Jill Edwards, still runs one in Brighton, I think, and it just gets you interested, and you start watching a lot more stand-up, and the people that inspired me in the 90s, this is about 96 97, the people who inspired me was watching old videos of Eddie Izzard, Bill Hicks, those, you know. And when I saw Eddie Izzard is probably the single person who made me go, oh, I can do that, because I thought, if a man can be that camp, that middle class, I can do it. Because I always thought stand-up was a bit for the tough boys, you know. And then I saw Eddie Izzard, I went, no, it's not. And what was lovely about him, which I certainly took years to ever achieve, was that thing that he doesn't apologize for himself. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? He just came out and went, whoa. So I would say it's a combination of watching Eddie Izzard and this friend of mine, Dave Klein, who was doing a stand-up comedy workshop. And all of these, there was lots of people in that workshop who just didn't continue doing it.
Right.
And people who've done that same workshop, it used to be at the City Lit, and then she ran it separately because there were other places. People like Jimmy Carr did it.
Yeah.
Simon Evans did it.
Yeah,
he was one of the people.
Yeah.
But there's only Addie Borg. You've seen Addie van der Borg? Very good.
Yeah.
He did it. But they weren't the same. My year, no one else continued. They did it for a bit, some of them. But it's that thing of whether I still felt, I remember walking down from this job at that I was doing at the BBC doing traffic reports, and I walked down to sign onto this course at the City Lit in London. And I remember thinking at the time, I think this is important. This could be the thing. Because I'd always felt as a bit of an actor, but then I also thought, this is like, you know, I was always scared of writing my own stuff. And I suddenly went, with comedy, there's no rules. It doesn't matter that your writing might be rubbish. It's
exactly.
If you're funny, that's all that matters, is if you're funny.
Yeah.
You don't have to be, you know, artistically superb. So So yes, sorry, that was. You'll find this with me, getting through questions is very difficult because I go on for half an hour on each question.
Please talk away, it's great. How was your first ever gig then after your City Lit course?
My first gig, was through these guys. So there was a group of these guys, David Klein, who I think teaches stuff now and does still write scripts. This other guy, Tony Elvin, and I can't remember. Oh, Nick, I'm still friends with one of them. Nick Ford. He is the guy most likely to watch this, Rich, and I've just forgotten his surname. Nick Ford. I saw him about 2 years ago. But there was a group of these guys, and they'd done the comedy course and were really into stand up.
Right.
And they ran a club in Notting Hill called the Crock of Wit.
Right.
And it was
the
Italian restaurant, and it was a tiny little room.
Yeah.
And we even got people. You know, I first saw Rob Brydon in that room and things. He was doing impressions and stuff. And I did my first gig there. And
wow.
Do you know what? That first, it still is absolutely one of the most amazing experiences I had. Was the first time you stand in front of a crowd and you've watched lots of stand-up and you know you've got your stuff, your jokes, and you get laughs from strangers.
I assume
I've never done heroin, but I assume it's like heroin. Basically, the first hit, I think somebody said that to me, I think the first hit actually of heroin might be terrible sometimes, it makes people sick, but it's like several drugs where the first hit is so amazing, and then you spend the rest of your life trying to chase it, the same hit. And I think the same with comedy. I don't think anything's ever been as exciting as that first moment when strangers laughed at me. And it was 25 people in a room.
It was my
sisters, I think, and my mum, all sitting in a row as well, watching.
Whenever I sit and watch a comedy show, the comedian has to walk out and they've got literally 1 minute, if that, to get the audience. Otherwise...
Exactly.
You know, you don't know what you're going to get. But if you're endearing, if you're very likable, if you've got a great one-liner, you're away. And you're very much like that. You're so wanting us to listen more to you, what you have to say, because you're so... I love the fact your frankness. I love the fact you can say whatever you like, and it's wonderful to watch. It really is.
Oh, thank you, Rich. That's very nice of you. I must admit, on my first gig, I'm not sure. Those are a lot of skills you learn. It was a very nice crowd.
It's all experience, isn't it? And I think you have to have difficult nights, shall we say, to gain the experience. You need to have the rough nights to become a better comic, I think.
Exactly. No, totally.
What has been your best and worst gig to date?
Best gig apart from my first gig, which did go well and was amazing. The actual gig that was the most exciting thing I've ever done and blew my mind. And it wasn't the biggest gig. It was still a big gig. It was the first time I did live at the Apollo.
Wow.
And even though I've done the O2, where you do Channel 4 Comedy Gala and it's 16,000 people or whatever, live at the Apollo, first time, because I've done it three times.
Yeah.
And I hosted it once.
One of them in the audience. I've been in the audience for it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It wasn't the first one. Which one was it? The slimmest one. The slimmest version. the best one was when I was quite slim. 2012. That was,
they record two shows, don't they? One after another.
And it, do you know what, that show, because it's so frightening with the big screen that goes up, it's so silly that people go, oh,
and
it looks quite because it goes, you do practice it before you do it at the sort of during the afternoon, and they go, look, smoke comes in and then the screen's going up, and then someone does usually shout go at you, or so go, and you, because it's safe, they go, don't walk forward too soon and you'll smack your head on the screen coming up. So there's all that technical stuff to remember, and you can't see anything. You walk straight into smoke and you walk out to the Apollo, and
just hear a wall of sound.
and I went out to that, and I watched the set again recently, and I still think it's one of the best sets I had. It wasn't my best dangerous material, most cutting. I mean, I had bits of it that was nice, but it was so perfect, that set. And I lay in bed that night. I think I used to put this. I used to said this in my last comedy show. I lay in bed that night going, I'm just such a star, I can't sleep. I was so excited. I just lay in bed going, well, I'm just a star. I'm obviously a star. And
you've got to beat yourself up, mate.
Yeah, exactly. But it was really just myself in bed, my wife quietly snoring beside me. And I just can't sleep. I've just done such a star. It was so perfect. I don't think any gig has ever felt so absolutely
That's
perfect.
Brilliant.
Just everything hit exactly the right way. I looked at it recently and went, oh, I'm so proud of that. So proud. I remember just coming off going, that was great. I
Good
absolutely nailed it. And it's still the one that it's still probably my best live at the Apollo, even though I hosted as well. Hosting is a bit messier because you're messing with the audience stuff.
Yeah.
And the last one was pretty good, actually, the last Christmas one I did. But I still, I enjoy. Yeah, the first one was just amazing. Just amazing.
Is there a worse one? Is there a worse
worst
one?
Probably, I would say probably the worst thing is the first time you die.
Right.
And that was, for me, that was about the 11th gig.
It's a good answer.
Yeah. It was the first time I died, which you've so, it's quite a big moment for comics because, I mean, some people who are amazing die on their first one and keep going. I'm not sure how I'd have done if I'd died in my first one. I died at my 11th gig or something because I was always quite a good performer. I couldn't get away with it. But suddenly I was on a set. I was doing a set with some quite good people. I think Ricky Grover was on.
Oh,
yeah, Ricky Grover was on. Big, good comics.
Yeah,
And it was in a pub in Wood Green that I'm always pleased about this. It was a pub and it's now a Tesco's. So it's, I love the fact that, no, I don't. I'm sorry about that pub in Wood Green. But yeah, it's now a Tesco's. Yeah. So I'm pleased that it went under. And I went on, it was quite a laddie crowd and someone, I went on, starting, someone went, be funny or something. And really at the beginning or something, I sort of handled it not very well. Went, oh, and I just died. And it was just looking at these faces of people. That's what you know, is that people think that you don't realize that you're annoying them, but you know you're annoying them. And you know you're trying to make it work. And it's not like you know, I think the thing is when you die as well, audiences so often just think, oh God, he's always this bad. It must always be, how is this? So sort of, if they're nice people, they're going, oh, he's having a bad night, so they feel sorry for you. But if you're angry at a comic for dying because you think he's rubbish and doesn't know it, you go, no, he's having a bad night. You're an idiot if you think he is just rubbish. Because I mean, I've never done this, but I would love to one time, because I still, you know, I might die at corporate events or something. Not to say that I'm not very good at corporate people watching this. But corporates are the most dangerous gigs we do now as professionals, because I would say, you know, if you do a lot, you might die once a year at a corporate. It might be one, it just goes wrong and the setup's terrible or whatever.
Right.
And I've never had the guts to do it, but I'd love to just one time stand in front of an audience and go, I know you're probably feeling uncomfortable, but it's always this bad. It's always this terrible. I die. I've been going over 20 years as a comedian. I pay a mortgage. I've brought up a family with the money I make from comedy. And I die like this every single time. Because when audiences get angry, that is sort of what they think. They sort of think, oh, he's just rubbish. He just must be bad. But I still remember that first death. And everybody else was storming. Everybody else was quite laddie. So like Ricky Grover types, all quite butch. And I went off and I went home. I was living with my mum for about 6 months. I think I just left a relationship and I was trying to get a new place in the flat. So I was with my mum for about 6 months. And I went in the little spare room at my mum's house, lay in bed going, well, and it was the first humiliation. And I lay in bed thinking, I'm still alive. I'm still, it doesn't actually kill you. You know, why do we call it death? I'm still lying here going, oh, I'm safe. And that's the thing to remember for comedians, I think.
That's brilliant. That's such a good answer. Let's go on to touring. I've seen you many times live, many, many times. I saw your Tough Lovey tour in 2014. I saw Straight Out of Cruttendon in 2016 and I saw Chubster in 2019. Do you enjoy touring and does the routine change at all from town to town?
I do love, I really like, I love touring, yeah. I must admit, even though it gets, the travel is always a pain, and there's always, you know, it's the night, because everybody's waiting for you. I've never been so late, it started late or anything.
Yeah.
And there was one time, it's the worry of if you're driving somewhere and if there's a car accident and they shut the road and you just go, that stresses me. In fact, do you know what? I once drove past quite a serious accident where nobody had got hurt, but there was stuff all over the carriageway and people were all out their cars on their phones. And I thought, and I was right close behind it. So I drove about a minute after this accident happened. I knew everybody was fine, but I just want to explain my behavior. There's a guy on his phone trying to call the police and, you know, ambulance and stuff. And I drove past and thought, they're going to shut the road for this. And I've made it through. And I went, yes, as I drove past. And knowing, oh my God, that could have been the end of the gig, because the police will shut this for 2 or 3 hours.
I've missed the town.
Exactly. And I caught this guy's eye who was on his phone. This guy's on his phone going, I've just been in a bad accident. And he saw me going, yes! Felt terrible. But apart from all that, it is such an honour to do your own tour. Yeah. It's all that I dreamt of as a comedian, I must admit. I mean, I obviously had big dreams. I want to be, I want to be Michael McIntyre, but slightly more dangerous. Yeah. I want to be controlling the world. I want to have Saturday evening, my own show.
Yeah.
But when to do a tour where people come to see you and you've got, especially when you've got both, I usually do both halves of the show. Yeah. Sometimes I have a warm up, but sometimes I have both halves of the show, and they're just there for you and they with you, and they often know you. So you don't have to do that, all that introduction that you have to do at a club where you feel like you're still slightly letting people know who you are.
Yeah.
Is just the biggest honour.
You can just get on with it and start generating the laughs. Yeah, it's brilliant.
And it's always worrying beforehand. It's always complete. I mean, that to me is such happiness. And I, you know, it is sad, but I would love to do a Tommy Cooper or Eric Morecambe, or Ian Cognito, and die either on stage or just as I come off.
Wow.
Because it is it's just the best thing in life as a comedian, is that I'm performing my crowd.
Yeah.
I just love touring. In terms of material changing different places, I would say the biggest change is probably in or outside London, actually.
Right.
London, even compared to other big cities, you can guarantee in London you've got people from everywhere. So you will probably have an Australian, an American, you'll probably have people from all.
Yeah.
So you can be very comfortable. You feel like you're playing the world, I think, when you're in London, usually. And you usually have, in the old days before COVID, we'd have lots of tourists, or we'd have lots of people from different backgrounds, or people who are living here from France or Germany or whatever. So I think that's very different. Whereas you can't, I always can make jokes about being somewhere like, I don't know, Lincoln, anybody from outside the county?
Yeah.
And you end up being very rude about them all being one family and all those sorts of jokes. So that's the biggest difference. I try and do something local. I try and do something, walk on stage in places like Glasgow and go, it's so lovely. It's so much nicer than you expect it to be. I would say different countries are different. For me, Belfast, because of all my Northern Irish wife stuff, Belfast is always a slightly different gig to everywhere else, because I find I do so much on Belfast and I tend to be ruder outside.
The impersonation of, I must imagine, your wonderful wife is priceless.
It is. It's very cruel. It's actually very inaccurate compared to the normal. I make her out to just be so terrifying Northern Irish woman. But I find the most different shows are being outside England. So Scotland, Wales, Ireland are certainly different shows when you go to somewhere like America or Canada or Australia. New Zealand's probably have to change less than when you go to Wales. But
my home city is Carlisle. But I live and work in London. I've been in London for the last 25 years. And I've seen you mainly in London, but I've seen you at Edinburgh as well. Have you ever played Carlisle, and would you ever think of doing it?
I think I have. I haven't toured to Carlisle.
I think I was.
But I've done gigs there. Well, what's the place?
Barrow Inverness. Yes.
Well, I opened there. This is absolutely true. I said, Barrow Inverness, I've looked you up. You're the most working class city in the UK. you are so my people. You Brilliant. Are my people. And they knew it. Yeah. So they did laugh.
I wish I'd been there.
Yeah, that was just hysterical, going, oh, you wouldn't think I'd be a good booking. But it was fine. It was lovely. I actually find people think it's tough. You know, you, Hal, you'll do well in Guildford bad in Liverpool. And actually, it's kind of rubbish. Yeah, people are... Certainly, you know, being the posh idiot, and I tend to play up the posh idiot, works better with an audience that isn't posh than an audience that is posh. Often a Surrey crowd will go, you're sort of making fun of us, aren't you? By making fun of yourself being a middle class twat.
It's like the old Ken Dodd story where he's describing what it's like to laugh, and he's describing a Freudian version of laughter, and he goes into very elongated words and everything. And the punchline is, mind you, ladies and gentlemen, Freud didn't play Glasgow Empire on a Friday night.
Exactly.
I've never forgotten that, because it must be different going round from town to town.
It is. But also, what is also lovely about touring, and this sounds like a real up your arse sort of comment, but because we live in this world of such division, and we tend to make judgments about different parts of the country, and the north is like this, London's like that, all these, you know, fishermen and even the generalizations, and the anger over things like Brexit and the Tories and Labour all those things. I think touring makes you love the country again. You actually realise we've got... I mean, because even I've had trouble with some of my political stuff. I would say I had trouble once in North Wales.
Right.
There was one beautiful gig, but there was one woman was angry that I was making fun of Trump or something. And this is a couple of years ago, yeah. Trump and Brexit. And I was doing some stuff. But the acceptance, because I'm not a lot of people don't come and see me expecting to see a lot of politics, and they get more than they expect, because they get about 10, 15 minutes of me often ranting at something in an hour and a half. I will put a bit in. And I'm obviously a bit of a nasty lefty liberal Remainer, but the acceptance from people with different opinions, I love. Yeah, but I really love the fact that so many people go, I don't agree with what you said politically, but I really enjoyed the show, and I went, you are my people. I love someone who can laugh at all our different opinions. Yeah, yeah. To me, and yes, I can be excessive, but I like to expect that an audience goes, he's sort of making fun of himself for being over the top. So I find it incredibly comforting to tour. It reminds you how much you like this country, or how much I like this country when I think I hate it. I'm always going, oh, I'm moving to Ireland.
I totally agree with that, because as a member of the audience, I like to travel around and see comedians in different cities and go to new venues and everything. I love that. And it's just the experience of going. As I said before, I've seen you live many times, either preparing or performing at the Edinburgh Fringe. Can you tell me what your first Edinburgh Festival was like? How daunting was it? Were you nervous?
Thing is, I had different ones. I had ones where I went up for a day to do a new act competition, late 90s. Yeah. And I also did a group show in 1999,
right,
which I hated, actually. I was in a group. No, I mean, it was with lovely people, like Mitch Benn. Mitch Benn was doing it. It was a group show, but it was just an unhappy time. Yeah. I wanted to be doing a full show. So the best one was the first time I did my first hour, which was like, I left it till 2002. I'd been going about 4.5, 5 years.
Right.
And I had a really good first Edinburgh. And I went there because I'd been there 3 years before doing a group show, and I hadn't really enjoyed it. I didn't expect to enjoy it. So I just was very focused, really hard working. I did about 65 gigs in a month or whatever, because I was also doing a group show plus my own show.
And you do other shows as well, don't you, for other people?
Yeah. So you go around, you try and get as much time as possible.
Yeah.
And because I was just working hard, I really enjoyed it. I think Edinburgh gets tough for comics if you try and be too sociable. Don't just get caught up. Your mind gets turned, going, oh, should I do that? Oh, should I be at that party? Oh, should I be doing this and that? And just put your head down and do it. Yeah. The fact is, it's not the same experience as visiting. I think to visit the Edinburgh Festival is fantastic.
Yeah.
To perform at, it's the audiences are seeing lots of other comedy, so it's the toughest crowds. It's tougher than going and doing a tour show.
Yeah.
and you will have bad nights, and you'll have reviewers who are 20 years old and students slagging you off, and you go, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, you know. So there'll be bits of Edinburgh that can turn your head, but actually, when you, I never don't enjoy the fact of performing there and just performing as much as possible.
I first went to the Fringe in 2005, and it's now my weekly holiday. I've been going for the last 16 years till 14 years till 2019, and in the week I see at least 50 shows. I cannot get enough of it, and I need a holiday when I come back. My liver is battered.
Well, it is. That's the thing. When there's no pressure, you don't have to do a show there. It's the wonderful place. Yeah. It's a wonderful place to be. But the thing is, it's obviously hard because you're at a festival and everybody's trying to get something out of it. Yeah, and I've had those great years. Like 2002 was a good year. I got nominated for the Newcomer Award. And then 2012 was a massive year for me because I suddenly got more TV coming to see me do my hour show. But you have to sort of you have to switch off from that to really enjoy it, because it brings out the you can get jealous of people, even though I feel closer to comics in Edinburgh than any other time, because we're all going through a slightly traumatic experience. You know, we're all going through this thing of, you also at the beginning, when it's a new show, you're changing your show a fair bit to try and get it better, ready to tour it. So it's stressful as a comedian, and you have to be very disciplined. Yeah, but overall, I love it. I've learned to love it again as my daughters have got older, because my daughters will now. My wife hated the years of me being stressed by it. So 2002, 2003, because we had little kids, and she'd come up for a few days or a week and find me too stressful. She hardly ever comes now to it.
Right.
My daughters, who are 18 and 20, they come up. They bring friends up.
That's fantastic.
And you see the festival again. They've been doing it since they were sort of 15, 16. And you see the festival again through young eyes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, my wife, she'll maybe come a night or two, but she doesn't like the atmosphere there. She finds it a bit too desperate. I said, it's not so desperate anymore. Now I'm more established. It's not as desperate.
That's brilliant. One of your greatest strengths as a comedian for me is that I love your rants, and when you rant, you tend to get quite nervy with your ranting. Do you suffer from nerves before you go on stage? And if so, how do you cope with them?
I do, but then I've always been terrible. I don't think I'm more nervous than other people. Unfortunately, I'm one of those very annoying people that's more vocal about my nerves. So I am the comedian that I am the one at the comedy store that's running around the dressing room going, I'll probably be shit tonight. I'll be shit tonight. I'm terrible. And everybody says that. But I've got that awful reputation of being the guy who goes, you know, I'm always joking, going, look, you're on before me. If you want to do some newer stuff and just mess about, and they go, of course I'm not going to do my newer stuff and be weaker just because you have to follow me. So I am very neurotic, but I also accept. The thing is, I've never walked away from a gig. I've never gone. And I've had, especially these corporate things where you're by yourself and you go to a business or you're in some big hotel ballroom. For some reason, they're the scariest because sort of there. They're not there for a comedy night. They're there for a business do, and they've got comedy on.
Yeah.
So it's a scary event. And I do all this big fuss in my head, but I don't actually run away, and I don't go, oh, I'm having a breakdown. And, you know, and I never have done. I've never run away. I've always sort of done things. So I do get nervous, but I think I'm actually a prima donna who just voices it more to myself.
I think though, as well, you do need a certain amount of nerves before you do anything in public, really. If you're doing a presentation or whatever. And that's of course what comedians do. You know, you've got a crowd in front of you.
And I think people often think that comedians are less frightened than ordinary people. And it's not that. It's that unfortunately the job we've chosen to do involves these nerves and it's probably the only thing we can do, and we have to deal with it to get to what we do. But also it's also that thing of, I don't know, as I get older, I always have something fluttering away inside me or getting nervous about things, but I'm learning to enjoy them, which is weird. And also the older you I'm learning to go, I quite enjoy the fact that it's so thrilling. I had to do one just during when lockdown was over, but it must have been October,
right,
where I was allowed to do a show. They put a festival on and they said, can you do an hour and a half?
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah, like a tour show, but I haven't really got a tour show anymore because my tour finished a year ago. Yeah. Can you do an hour and a half to our audience? That we'll all be sort of wearing masks and socially distanced, but do two halves. And I said, oh God, but I can't do this bit from the tour show and I can't do that. And I've got to include loads of stuff about COVID. And I almost, because I was so nervous about it, it was in my diary of me going, I just haven't got done the gigs to get gig fit enough to be good enough for this evening. But I also knew when I was terrified before going on to do this thing, I thought, you're going to enjoy this because the kick is going to be great when this goes okay. Yeah, and it went well. And I was like, that's great. I can just produce an hour and a half and keep them interested. And it's that thing of, it sounds cocky, but you surprise yourself by going, and it is just experience. You surprise yourself by going, I can handle a hell of a lot now. And it's pathetic to say that after, you know, it's been 23 years since I first did a stand-up gig. 24 years.
That's incredible.
24 years. And yet I'm still going, I don't think I could do that. I don't think I've got to do that.
You touched on what I want to talk about next. Can you describe your writing process and how you remember your routines? Do you have a way of remembering them?
I don't know. I don't have a way of remembering them.
Right.
Because
have like pointers
they...
or anything that make you go along?
Oh, I sort of, yes, I know the sort of order I'm going in. That just gets quite entrenched when I'm doing bits. Like, I'll put that bit in there and that bit, and when I'm doing normal gigs. If you're doing real new material sets and you're building a new show, right at the start, you've got a pad with you.
Right.
So you go, because it's new. But so that's the different thing between a show and a normal gig, because you have gigs where you're just doing your best stuff. And you'll do stuff from any, you know, the last 5-6 years. My writing process used to be so much more structured when I was new.
Right.
So there's two different types of writing comedy. I think I can't remember the name of the guy. The guy where you do columns of words and it's all to do with writing, you know, jokes. I preferred this method called rant and rave, which is just basically like venting. You're venting everything.
I
and you
love
have
that.
Taken you take an extreme emotion and you just vent it and you literally just say it into a microphone and you write it all down. 20 years ago I would be saying doing that style. Now I tend to go, oh, that's a good joke, and I get one really good idea. And it's the one that's going to probably be the biggest line of the set. And then you just try and write around that idea. And I think I did it like the other night. I did a joke it's just an idea. It's not even a joke yet, but I want to build more on it. And it's on the fact that now, as I get older, I realize all I'm doing when I read self-help books or spiritual books is basically books that just tell me what I want to hear. So when you're young, they're all like, feel the fear and do it anyway, get ahead with things, do stuff. And now all the self-help books I read are like, hey, success isn't that important. It doesn't matter how much money you've got. Hey, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how happy you are in whatever you're doing and whether you've achieved all your dreams in life. Life's much more about just being present. And you go, I'm just hearing what I want to hear. You know, I'm just getting older. You know, I'm just middle-aged and going, everybody who's middle-aged, whatever you've done in life has loads of, oh, have I achieved everything I want to achieve? Probably not. Oh, it's all, you know. And
any specific themes you like to talk about? What do you like to mainly talk about on stage? Is it just like family life or?
Well, it ends up being loads of family things just because at the moment, especially with the family so much at the moment, and my wife's always a brilliant inspiration because she's very funny and she said, and it just sets me off.
Yeah.
And my kids, as they get older, you know, because they've been little kids, so I've got all the little kids jokes I used to have, and now they're grown women, you know, 18 and 20. There's all those jokes.
You had a great story about being in a cinema with them.
Oh, yes, we were with Martha and people, yes. And that
Sorry
was real.
To interrupt.
No, but all that's real. Yeah, that's all the thing of when people think your daughter might be your girlfriend. Yeah, it's that. Yes, it's
that's particularly good.
Yeah, and now my daughters have heard that. They find that hilarious, and now they bring it up every single time we're out anywhere without my wife there. If I'm with one of them, they go, "Do you think, Daddy? Do you think, you know?" And they try. But all those things. It's that moment of you have like a bit of inspiration and go, that's funny. And the fun bit is creating the set around, you know, the bits around that, and create, and that's where the work really goes on. Usually the inspiration just happens. I mean, the weird thing about stand-up is, I mean, I've really got to be writing more at the moment, but I find the best ideas come to me when I go, I'm not writing for 3 weeks. I won't write, try and write stand-up for a month or something. I'll do something else. I'll write a sitcom. I'll do this. I've got my podcast. I've got things that I'm doing. Don't write stand-up. And that's when you've got ideas on your phone the whole time, because you just, you have to go out and just live life. And have things happen. And it's why lockdown has been hard for people with material. That's what they're all saying, that people are going, not a lot new is happening. So you're not having that thing that happens that just sparks off an idea that and that's why we get, I've probably got too much angry politics stuff, because we're all getting too involved in politics.
It's exactly the same for me watching it. Comedy is my way of dealing with the situation we're in with the pandemic. If I couldn't have online comedy or live comedy, I don't know what I would have done. But even I can't go to a comedy night every night. I'd be absolutely exhausted. I'll go most nights, but not every night. But I completely understand that you have to get away from it, even though you love doing it or love watching it.
But weirdly, the best, the most satisfying jokes you ever write is when there's something that you really need to get out of your system. And it's it can be about yourself, it can be about positive, about something, but those are the jokes where you go, yes, I finally found a way to make what makes me so angry funny, or me so scared funny. And that's why, it's complete therapy. People go, oh, comedy's therapy, it's very bad for you, it's about hiding emotions. It isn't necessarily. It's often about just expressing how we actually feel. And because of the laughter, you're getting people going, yes, I know what you mean. And that's just, you know, it's just
like
wonderful.
You're like a spokesman for everybody in the audience, exactly how they're feeling. Even if they can't say it, a comedian will just say it and say it in their particular style that makes it hilarious for the audience watching. It's extraordinary to see. Do you have any ambitions as a comedian? Do you have anything you would like to achieve, or are you happy as you are? I know we're living in tough times at the moment, but in the normal world, do you want to do you have any main big ambitions as a comedian to fulfill, or?
They're not, maybe this is age. I have dreams that I don't necessarily expect to happen. But I don't have anything more than anything else. The most important thing is to keep on enough of a profile to still be touring as a comedian. To write a new show is always the next dream.
Yeah.
But in terms of other things, I would love, and I am writing now, and I might be completely the wrong age profile for this, but I have a very good idea for a sitcom that I've already written an episode and a half of, basically.
That's brilliant.
But I'm quite insecure. I've never written a sitcom by myself, and I'm just doing it now. I'm just going, do you know what? I want to write this. My agent has seen what I've written so far, and my agent said, really like this, keep going. I'm quite excited by doing this. I'm going, okay, but I just want to, for me, an absolute dream would be my sitcom. I've written it, I'm starring in it. It's the whole Ricky Gervais dream, you know?
But
that would be, if I got that, I always say, I said to someone, the other day I was saying this, if I ever got that, I can never moan again. You cannot let me moan, because I will have achieved absolutely what I want. Now, I don't necessarily expect to get my own sitcom happening.
I hope you do, mate.
If it does, it would be
amazing. I would be watching, definitely.
Oh,
I really would. I think it's a great idea. You'd be perfect for. Would you be appearing in it, or would you just be writing it, or?
I would be appearing in it, because then it mixes up my two, you know, because I was an actor. I still am an actor. Occasionally do acting
seen
things.
I've been in plays at the Edinburgh Fringe,
I've done a couple of plays there. But you know, this is where I started, and I don't do much acting now. Right. And I must say my first love is still stand-up. But to have your own creation, I had a Radio 4 sitcom that got, you know, did a couple of scenes of that I wrote with Dominic Holland, and it was so amazing to get something that's your creation together.
Yeah.
And you get all these actors in, you get, you know, really good people like Ronnie Ancona and it was just so to be, if I ever got that off the ground with a TV thing, it would be fantastic.
Yeah.
But I would be doing it from a weird demographic, because usually they don't give people over 50 their first sitcom. But I happen to think we get funnier as we get older.
Oh, tell me about it. I think I do, and I'm over 50. We are all living in strange times. It's a very weird time to be living. How have you found online gigs as opposed to live gigs?
I do. Do you know what? In a weird way, they're less intense than a live gig.
Yeah.
You never feel you can storm in quite the same way as you can live, and you can't die in quite the same way as you can live.
Off with a button.
Yeah, it does take away the fear element of being right there, having to face people when things go, you know. But I just think it's fine. And I've really enjoyed doing, I really do enjoy doing loads of them, actually. I enjoyed that one that, you know, you saw the other night. I did lots of them over Christmas with Christmas parties and things. And I really enjoyed them. I love the fact that you can go to people in their different boxes and make fun of their house and, you know, all that sort of stuff and what's going on. And suddenly their dog walks past and their little kid jumps over there.
Yes.
That's lovely. You know, it is lovely to have that, but, and it's been, you know, when you have had a break and you haven't done live stand-up for a while, and this happened in the summer, I'd done car park gigs where people were sitting in their cars, leaning out the window, and that was okay.
Yeah.
And I did online gigs, and then I did an outdoor gig that usually you would go, this is tough. It was outdoor, but people sitting on the ground. This was in July. It was in North London. People sitting on the ground, and watching you, and honestly, all the comics on the bill hadn't done a live gig to an audience sitting there.
Wow.
For since March, you know, this was in after the first lockdown, and it was quite emotional. You did suddenly go, this is amazing, because you're directly, you're down here talking to this guy and that guy, and they're right there, and it's just much more immediate, and that you really felt the laugh sweep over you in a way that you don't in the same way online. You do sort of online, but you know, some people are muted, some people are listening, and when it comes back, I think there'll be tears again when it comes back again.
Believe me, I totally agree with you. It's so great to have this medium, but for me you can't be live, because you never know what's going to happen.
Exactly.
And the atmosphere and all the rest of it. Who are your favorite comedians, past and present? Do you have any? Or I know it's a massive question.
It's so hard, that question. It really is. I have
The reason I ask it is because the reason why I write the blog is because of Morecambe and Wise, and I know they're universally loved, but they're one of the few acts that I didn't get to see. I met Eric Morecambe's wife, and I've read everything about them and all the rest of it. But I did get to see Les Dawson, I saw Tommy Cooper, Ken Dodd, Rick Mayall, and these Peter Kay, Frank Skinner in the 80s. And so there are so many very good memories for me, but I just wondered if there was any specific comics that come to mind with you.
Well, as I said, Eddie Izzard sort of inspired me at the beginning. And still, you know, I still think brilliant comic. I would say, when he was on the circuit, and I haven't seen him, you just don't see that much comedy. Because, I mean, when you're usually, well, I should be trying to watch more. I've just realised that. I was watching more stand-up during the first lockdown, and I should be watching more again now. Because you don't tend to watch, basically, because you're going, oh God, maybe it'll affect me, and maybe a joke will seep in, and I'll just be producer. So you worry about that. But I did watch, who did I watch? I was saying, I haven't seen him for ages, but was on the circuit. Lee Mack is an
fantastic.
Amazing star.
Lee Mack,
to me, Lee Mack is a modern Eric Morecambe.
In terms of, he is
so good. He's just funny man.
I saw him at the Banana Cabaret, the Bedford Arms, and he headlined that. And then I saw him at the Hammersmith Apollo. It was Hit the Road, Mack, and I was crying at him.
Because he
that's
worked.
That's going some for me.
Yeah, well, I think. I think as a comic, I really appreciate those comedians that whatever they're saying, they guarantee there's jokes in there.
Yeah.
And they, and there's a real temptation amongst some comics, and it's not many, to get indulgent. Yeah. Get to, and just, so I tell you one who I thought think is fantastic for not doing this, and who I watched recently was Jim Jefferies.
Oh, he's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. He just saunters on. And
I knew him quite, you know, quite well on the circuit. Yeah. I knew him years ago. I haven't seen him for about 7 years or something.
He's been around for a while, yeah.
No, he's sort of big, and he's so big in America now. But he walks out to what I find really annoying, particularly about American audiences, but it happens here as well. He walks out to that, he's cool, because he's, do you know those sort of people?
Really annoying.
Those people who they, but they whoop as a sort of way of going, whoa, I love Jim, because I'm cool. I'm the cool guy. Look at me, I'm wooing, and I know his stuff. I've seen all of them, I've seen all the shows. You know, there's kind of audience members that, I mean, we do it a bit here with Stuart Lee, and stuff. Like, you're Stuart Lee, this is Stuart Lee fan. You go, oh, fuck, Stuart Lee is brilliant, but you are using Stuart Lee to be more interesting when you don't have enough about yourself to be interesting. This one gets me. That's what I think. I'm actually Stuart. I've got to say Stuart Lee. I do say that while saying it's one of my favourite comics. Yeah. But I hate Stuart Lee wankers. I hate people who are Stuart Lee's amazing, because they like him because it just shows that I'm really bright and clever. You piss off, because there's, you know, I love, you know, I think every comic, people were snooty about, like Lee Evans was a great
comic.
He was, you know, and it's, I hope he still
the
does some
visual gags that he did, the visual end to the joke was inspired, the funny face and everything.
Exactly. And yet people were a bit snooty because he was a bit that cartoon. But I think love the people that work so hard at the jokes. And I note with Jim Jefferies, he's got all that love and he's got all that passion, and he makes points and he's rude and he's aggressive and he's got that tough guy image, but he never forgets the funny.
No.
He never forgets to be funny. Yeah. And I was watching him going, you deserve everything, Jim, because you play up the, hey, I don't give a shit. No, I'm kind of drunk all the time. Anyway, I don't think he does drink anymore. I'm not sure if he does anymore. But I just remember watching him last summer and go, oh, you're still so good.
Yeah,
you're still
so,
and you've not got too sucked into the, hey, listen to me, I'm a prophet thing.
Very much so, yeah. I totally agree with that. Like me, do you go to comedy as a member of the audience a lot?
Hardly ever.
Every comedian in Edinburgh I've interviewed so far said no.
Yeah, I really don't. In Edinburgh, I'll see a few shows. I'll try and see other stuff. They won't admit why, and I. It's because we're jealous often. they go, yo, well, no, it's good enough. No, you're jealous. I occasionally, I will see things. I'm always trying to see more. It's quite hard. So what I think it's less fun when you do stand up, watching other stand-ups, because you also can see how things are done. You do know, you can sort of work it out a little bit, not with everybody, but you just, you're watching it with a different head on.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you first of all, you're never sucked into the, hey, he's just making it up as he goes along stuff, you know, which some people are, apart from if it's like Ross Noble or someone. But but you just, I'm really forcing myself to, as a comic, to watch more. And I think part of it is, you know, watching Jim Jefferies and go, I want to be in the massive theatre. You know, I love the arts centres, I do. Yeah. As long as I have a big theatre. But, so I think there's a thing of competition as well.
Right.
But I forget how much it does inspire me watching other people.
Yeah.
It does make me go, shit, that's brave.
Yeah.
I love seeing comics. I go, God, you're brave to say that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And still, when they still surprise me, Jim Jefferies will do that. You know, they'll just be so honest about something.
You're sitting there thinking, has he really said that? And then, but thank God he said it, as you said.
Exactly. Yeah, and I have got braver the longer I've gone, but I'm not that brave.
Oh, yeah. It's good to see, though.
but I, you know, that really is my thing of going, because that's when the great comics are, the people that will really just not give a damn, you know. So I love that. I love people who don't give a damn what people think and really do just, you know, just take that risk of saying the unsayable. But also I love the people that work hard and always give you a joke. It's like I find it moving, actually, that I know Lee Mack is not going to take a tour show out and not be really funny.
Jim
Jefferies is always going to have a punchline at the end. And the same way Morecambe and Wise were, you know, you want to make your points, but the main thing is you want to, you've got to give them a present. You've got to give them the laugh every time, you know.
That's such a good answer, because whenever I look at them, I always think there's an extra layer to them. So with Eric Morecambe, it was the glasses, or Tommy Cooper was the fez or the magic, or and to do that without doing anything and getting an audience laughing is just genius. It really is, and that's what lives on in the memory.
Exactly.
I miss going to. I saw you at Headliners, and I saw you at the Soho Theatre, and I miss going to venues like this, because the diverse range of acts and everything that they get there. And just to finish off the interview, is there anything else you would like to mention? Is you say you were writing a sitcom, are you writing any books, have you got any podcasts?
I do a podcast. Rich, you remind me, the way your attitude to comedy is my attitude to rugby, by the way, because I'm a bit, as you know, I'm actually wearing the Saracens rugby shirt, which is a very, very unpopular rugby club, but I have a rugby podcast that I do with Dan Skinner, who is, you know, Angelos Epithemiou. So he does that character, but he does it as himself, and it's us talking rugby for about 45 minutes a week. We usually have a guest on. We've had some big rugby names so far. David Soul, who was, if you're not a rugby fan, you won't know, but he was Scotland captain 1990, marched the team out to beat England, and Lewis Moody, who was played for England and captained England in the 2011 World Cup, it was, but he was on the field for the 2003 World Cup. So we get good guests on, and it's called Rugby Jubbly, and it's mainly fans, it's mainly us as fans talking about rugby, and it's making us even more obsessive. I thought I was quite obsessed by Saracens rugby. I'm becoming obsessed by everybody. I know so much about rugby at the moment, because I have to prepare for this podcast.
Yeah.
And even though games are off, we're now, Dan laughs at me because I'm a bit over the top compared to him, but we're now doing analysis of old games. So at the moment, I'm literally downstairs. Downstairs, I got YouTube up on my big TV to watch Australia New Zealand 2000, which apparently was the best game of this century.
Wow,
and we're
brilliant.
Doing another. So it's sort of, if you are a rugby fan, please have a listen, because it is us sort of from quite an idiotic perspective, making silly comments about rugby and pontificating, and we're deciding which team is winning. You know, I'm always making outrageous comments. Yes, no, I mean, if you know anything about rugby, I have the most ridiculous theories that, like, we don't need defence coaches in rugby, and Eddie Jones should have resigned 2 years ago, and that's all. Like, I make ridiculous comments anyway.
Are you writing any shows, any new material?
I've already got shows booking in for early 2022.
Wow, good man.
So my agent is booking my next tour. They were hoping, I mean, they keep going, have you got a title, have you got a title? And now they've gone quiet, which means I think Edinburgh's definitely not happening.
I'm not sure, I don't think so.
I don't think it is, because they usually go, we need a title, need a theme. So I'm formulating my next show. But I that is also the happiest times in when you're making your next show. It is so wonderful, because you have bits, you start off going, can I do an hour? Oh God, what have I got? and the themes you want in it. And when you see it coming together and write, and it makes you write, it's the most exciting thing. So I know you enjoy watching comedy or anything, but when you get a great joke, I mean, I say it's great to perform on stage. The other great moment is that moment you're sitting writing, you go, that's it, that's the joke. And you just take the rest of the day off.
It's like a light bulb going off. Yeah.
And it is. It's the most exciting thing. And it is, you know, however much I've moaned so much in life, but I keep having these moments of going, God, it's so wonderful to do this as a job. Because it really isn't.
Well, the amount of joy and humor you give off is extraordinary, you know. And I was chatting the other night to another comedian, and he said, I did a gig for like 20 people or something, and I said, even that, you've made joy for those 20 people, and that is something wonderful, you know. It's fantastic. I really do wish you every success, and I'm delighted that you've been my guest today. I've so much enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure, Rich. I love talking about myself.